Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest this afternoon is Adam Cohen, author of Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, and he is a member of the New York Times editorial board. Meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the Advocates.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Adam Cohen is a lawyer and an author with a particular interest in legal issues, politics, and technology. Before joining the Times editorial board in 2002, he was a senior writer at Time magazine, where he wrote about the Supreme Court, internet privacy, and focused quite a bit on the Microsoft antitrust case, among other topics. Prior to entering journalism, he was an education reform lawyer and a lawyer for the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Along with Nothing to Fear, he's the author of The Perfect Store Inside eBay and co-authored American Pharaoh about Richard J. Daley, the mayor of Chicago, his battle for Chicago and the nation. He's a native of Manhattan, a graduate of Bronx High School of Science, Harvard College, and Harvard Law School. Adam, you are a native New Yorker who was raised in Manhattan, went to college and graduate school in Boston, where I received my education. My children have lived for many years. The Northeast has been the bastion of liberalism and the Democratic Party for, let's say, the better part of this past century. You've written an excellent book about FDR's first 100 days, which has become the measuring rod, for better or worse, of all the presidents have followed. First of all, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I love American history, so I love a good narrative about American history. I wanted to do that, and I was looking for a time period that really spoke to the moment. And when I was looking for a subject, it was the middle of the Bush administration, and a lot of what was being fought over in American politics was the New Deal. President Bush began his second term talking about rolling back, privatizing Social Security. There were panel discussions in Washington about rolling back the New Deal. So I wanted to go back to first principles and find out, why did the New Deal come about? What were its goals? Where did it come from? And what did it achieve? And looking at the 100 days was really the way to do that.
There's no doubt this is a hallmark. I know William Lichtenberg has written about all the presidents following FDR in his book, In the Shadow of FDR. And of course, a lot of that had to do with 100 days. You know, because of the recent collapse of many financial houses, the banks, the insurance giant AIG, the automobile companies, and the housing market, we've entered into a period that is eerily representative and somewhat similar to the Great Depression. Of course, not exactly. With that in mind, could you set the scene that was unfolding on March 4th, 1933, which is almost 77 years ago, and why was that period of time so critical?
Sure. It was an amazing moment in history. It was the depths of the Great Depression. So when FDR took office, 25% unemployment, the stock market had fallen 85%, and the banking system had collapsed. Every bank in the country was actually closed, had a banking holiday by the time FDR took office. The Farm Belt was in dire straits. The Depression had actually begun on the farms in the 1920s when crop prices began to fall, not the 1930s. So the country was really in dire straits. There was a general recognition that President Hoover had failed to address the Great Depression in any serious way. So a landslide victory for FDR in the 1932 election, and people really are hoping that he's going to somehow rescue the country from the worst economic crisis it had ever seen.
You know, And just to elaborate on that, when FDR came into office in that dark, worrisome period following the crash, we had had approximately 40 months of a declining economy, which, of course, is known today as the Great Depression. And as you mentioned, the unemployment rate was obviously between 25%. It was probably quite a bit higher. And of course, in those days, it was a principle. One person in the family worked, you know, and not what a lot of people don't realize is that 9 million people lost their complete savings because there was no FDIC. There was no unemployment insurance. There was no social safety nets. I mean, this country was in trouble. Adam, how desperate were the people? And was March 1933 Is it anything comparable to what happened in the late fall of 2008?
Well, there certainly are parallels, and it was interesting to me that just as the book was getting ready to come out, the Lehman Brothers bank collapsed, and it started the banking crisis of 2009. So there were a lot of strong parallels. That said, the terrible times we've gone through in the last couple of years don't begin to compare to the Great Depression. As you say, people lost their life savings as banks failed. Very often, the only wage earner in a family was unemployed and had no prospects of finding another job. In the Farm Belt, it didn't pay to plant crops because farmers couldn't sell them for the cost that they put into raising the crops. And if you walked around a big city, what you would see would be the famous bread lines and soup lines, huge lines of unemployed people just desperate to get a handout of food because there also were not food stamps and programs like that. And, I talked to people who lived through it who said, you would walk around New York City and you would see families on the sidewalks surrounded by their belongings, just sitting on the sidewalk. They had been thrown out of their apartments because they were unable to pay rent, and they literally did not know where they were going to go next. Mm-hmm. So times were really very, very grim.
It's interesting that I've always wondered this as a student of FDR and the New Deal, what the suicide rate was in those days. Very little talked about, but I can imagine it was incredibly high. And, of course, as you painted that picture, there were men selling apples on the street. There were Hoovervilles that literally the whole West Side of New York near the Hudson River was a sprawling Hooverville. And there were many of these all over the country in those days. But, in your book, Nothing to Fear, which comes from FDR's famous first inaugural, you talk about FDR's first inner circle, the Brain Trust. Who were these individuals? Where were they from? And how long did they actually influence FDR?
So when FDR decided as governor of the state of New York that he would run for president, he put together a brain trust, a group of experts, largely academics, who could advise him on policy issues that he could use in his campaign and help him write speeches. A guy named Raymond Moley, who's one of the five people I focus on in the book, who was a professor at Columbia, was charged with heading up the Brain Trust and recruiting other members of the Brain Trust. And because he was at Columbia University and they didn't have much of a budget, it was very easy for him to focus initially on hiring people who were also at Columbia so they could meet very cheaply, didn't need to pay any travel expenses, and it was all very convenient. So he began to bring in people like Adolph Burl, who was another Columbia professor, a corporations expert, to advise the campaign about corporations. A guy named Rexford Tugwell, who was actually Moley's neighbor on Claremont Avenue in Morningside Heights, just one door down, who was an economics professor, advised the campaign on agricultural issues, and so on. So that Brains Trust was a very dynamic force during the presidential election of 1932. Moley was the main speechwriter during that campaign, wrote a lot of speeches based on the memos that these experts came up with, the policy advice. And after the election, Raymond Moley joins the administration and becomes FDR's closest advisor. He was actually on the cover of Time magazine during the 100 days as the man closest to FDR, and became the conduit even when FDR was president for a lot of these brain trust ideas about how to combat the Depression and how to run the government. So it was a very dynamic force in the election and in FDR's presidency, and it really reveals, I think, a very positive side of FDR, which is that he was very open-minded, very open to new ideas, and he had a real respect for expertise. He was looking for people who understood issues better than him to give him advice.
Now, of course, you talk about and you focus on the 100 days. What happened in retrospect to these, the I would call the remaining triumvirate, Tugwell, Burley, and Moley? What happened to them? Was there falling out? How did they, the rest of it, was the New Deal and the FDR presidency lasted over 12 years. What happened to these individuals after, though, that initial period?
Well, each one has their own story. And, there were people that I write about who were very loyal to FDR, and he was very loyal to them, and they remained there all 12 years. So Frances Perkins, who's one of the heroes of my book, actually worked for FDR when she was governor of the state of New York, became labor secretary on the first day of his administration, and was still labor secretary when he died. Harold Ickes, the same thing at Interior, was with FDR the whole ride. There were some New Dealers who came and went, and Tugwell had various positions, including in the Agriculture Department, but he remained part of the administration.
He was really a loyal New Dealer.
A loyal New Dealer, and FDR was loyal to him. But there were those with whom FDR did have a falling out and vice versa. And one of those, as you mentioned, was Raymond Moley, who Moley was FDR's closest advisor, as I mentioned, during the 100 Days. But he had a strange position. Although he was still a speechwriter and wrote a lot of FDR's messages to Congress, he was formerly an assistant secretary of state. That was a place where FDR thought he could put him. It turned out not to be a very good place because Moley was not actually doing secretary of state work very much, and he ended up clashing with the secretary of state in part because Cordell Hull, who was the secretary of state, was jealous that Moley, his subordinate, had such a close relationship with FDR. Moley ends up clashing with Cordell Hull and ultimately being pushed out of the administration, and that went very badly. And at the beginning, Moley remained somewhat loyal to FDR, but he began to turn on him, and in the famous court packing fight of 1937, when FDR threatened to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court because New Dealers were not happy with some of the decisions from the court, Moley was very critical of FDR. Moley ended up opposing FDR's election to a third term, and in the end, Moley ends his life as a Goldwater Republican. So you have that very unusual trajectory, but there were New Dealers who stayed and New Dealers who went.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Of course, Moley was very unhappy about the gold situation and the London Economic Conference. And it's interesting how you mentioned Cordell Hull, because Cordell Hull is really one of the middle of the road. He's a longtime senator from Tennessee, basically more of a moderate to conservative. And really, he really suffers at the hands of FDR for 11 years, almost 11 years. He doesn't finish out the term at the end of his term, FDR's third, and into his fourth term, FDR appointed Edward Stettinius. But Hull is really an interesting character. That you talk about a loyal player. He certainly was one. And he felt, and you can read the quotes, that he felt quite abused by FDR, unfortunately. They never really were close at any time. You know, as you focused, of course, on the 100 days, you talk in depth about the legislation that was pushed out in those 3 months, and it's an incredible amount. There were 15 pieces of major legislation that were approved. How did Congress digest all that was written? And did even the committee chairman know what was in all those bills?
No, it stands in stark contrast to what's going on today with our current president. The Congress back in 1933 was quite deferential to FDR, and that goes for Republicans as well as Democrats. There was enormous pressure from the public to see something done, anything done, and there was a lot of belief that FDR should be given the opportunity to lead the country almost as he wanted. So a lot of the bills that he sent to Congress were almost rubber stamped, and in the case of the first bill, the Emergency Banking Act, it wasn't even read by members of Congress. There weren't drafts available, but people were that willing to give him deference. And during the 100 days, that changed a little bit, and Congress did push back on some issues. And sometimes Congress was right. One of the things that Congress insisted on is in the second big banking bill of the 100 days, they wanted federal deposit insurance, which is something FDR actually did not support. And Congress insisted, they prevailed, and now we think of one of the great successes of the New Deal as being the creation of FDIC and federal deposit insurance. But it was pushed on FDR by Congress. That said, though, that was unusual. By and large, almost everything that FDR wanted at the beginning of his administration from Congress, he did get.
You know, it's also interesting. There's been a recent book on FDR. Obviously, there have been hundreds, in fact, thousands of books on FDR called The Juggler. And FDR really had to pay attention and give tremendous amount of deference to the South, because most of the chair people under the seniority system that existed in Congress up until recent days, and there's still seniority system, most of the chairpersons, and I could say chairmen because there were no women as chairman, in the House and the Senate were Southerners because of their long seniority. And this would come into play later on in his administration, dealing with the two big issues that were controversial, one Lend-Lease and the other immigration. To keep these congressmen, these Southern conservatives on their side for Lend-Lease, he had to be very, very conservative on immigration, which is a sore point even today. You know, getting back to those 100 days and how critical they are, Ben Cohn and Thomas Corcoran, known as Mr. Inside and Outside of the administration, that's sort of like Blanchard and Davis, you know, for the old Army football teams of the 40s, had a great deal to do with the first Security Act of 1933. Who were these men, and what role did they play regarding the critical reform on Wall Street?
Well, you know, I often like to beg off and say that I don't really know anything that happened after the 100 days. They did come down after the 100 days, pretty much. They came down towards the end of the 100 days. But they were incredibly influential. They were students of Felix Frankfurter's at Harvard. And as you described, they had very different personalities. Ben Cohen was, many people described him as the most brilliant of the New Dealers, just an intellectual giant. And he was the drafter of the Securities Act and of a bunch of other important New Deal laws. And Corcoran was more, the guy who could buttonhole people on Congress and convince them to support a lot of these bills. So they were an amazing team. They were very close, and they and together came up with a lot of the major bills. And another example of how FDR just had a real ability to attract people of great talent and to fill the various niches that he needed. There was an enormous amount of legislation that had to be written on very complicated areas. I mean, you know, now we have a lot of laws governing the securities industry, and you know, you can read treatises on it. But back then, a lot of almost all of the rules about securities were at the state level, and to come in and create a vast federal law governing it was a highly complicated thing to do. And the administration was able to bring in, you know, some of the top minds to do it.
And, of course, they were treading in waters that no one really knew about. These waters were had problems with minefields, you know. There were mines. There were shallow water shoals, you know. It was, as Roosevelt liked to reflect, that it was he was sailing the ship of state, of course, and he was at war with the Depression. And one of the things that was happening with government in those days, and people hadn't gone this path of regulation and reform. Of course, Ben Cohn remained an insider in Washington for another 40 or 50 years. And Corcoran, who was known as Tommy the Cork, was probably what one could say the first super lobbyist, you know. And he actually left the New Deal, the FDR administration, after around 7 years, and made his name in other areas up until, I believe, the 1970s and 80s. You know, I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com with myself, Richard Garfunkel, my guest, Adam Cohn, author of Nothing to Fear, about FDR's famed first 100 days, and a member of the New York Times editorial board. I first met Adam up at Hyde Park at the Summer Roosevelt Book Fest in 2009. I've seen him on panels at both the Harvard Club and the New York Historical Society, talking about his book and the critical period of the 100 days. You know, Adam, as you articulated earlier, the Brain Trust, which consisted of academics from Columbia University, lost influence pretty early in the New Deal. Who were the new people in FDR's inner circle, and how did they come to FDR?
Well, you know, a lot of these people came to him through fairly random routes. So one that I actually described the route of is Harry Hopkins, who became one of FDR's closest advisors throughout his presidency. He'd actually moved into the White House. Well, Hopkins had actually worked for FDR when he was governor of the state of New York, running the first emergency relief program in New York State. But he didn't really know Governor Roosevelt. He just had been appointed to this job. And then when Roosevelt becomes president, Hopkins would very much like Roosevelt to adopt a similar emergency relief plan, a major welfare plan for the victims of the Depression, and he wouldn't mind running it. But he actually has no way to get in to see FDR or anyone in the White House. So he shows up in Washington one day and drops in on Frances Perkins, who he knows a little bit from New York, and he and a colleague bring her a plan for a relief program and tell her that FDR has to do this and people are suffering. She likes the plan, and she sells FDR on the plan, and then they need to choose someone to run it, and it's kind of a toss-up between Harry Hopkins and then the other guy who went down with him, another New York social worker, and they end up picking Hopkins in part because the other guy worked for the city of New York, and FDR didn't feel good about poaching him. So anyway, it's just this almost random series of events that gets Hopkins into the inner circle. He becomes a huge force as the head of first the Federal Relief Agency, then the WPA, the famous Public Works Program. Then he becomes incredibly close to FDR personally, moves into the White House, and becomes a close advisor and a very important advisor during World War II. So, Hopkins' story is so quirky, but in many ways it embodies the sort of random ways in which people get sort of thrown into FDR's orbit, and if he likes them, if they're doing good work, they rise up. And so some went that route when FDR's first Treasury Secretary, William Wooden, leaves. He was in bad health the whole time that he was in the cabinet. FDR taps his old neighbor, Henry Morgenthau, from upstate New York. They had neighboring farms in Dutchess County. So that's a very different route. But people came to FDR through many routes and, as I mentioned, stayed long times or short times, depending on how it all worked out.
Well, it's also interesting, of course, that Hopkins was a social worker, basically, out of Grinnell College in Iowa. And he was a very, very sympathetic to the poor. And he, one of the famous quotes about Hopkins was when he was in front of a senatorial committee being grilled over, his writing of checks. And that's what Hopkins did quite a bit. He wrote checks for billions, in a very plain office and a plain desk. He just did it. He said to a senator, people don't eat in the long run. And that sort of, characterized Hopkins. And of course, for our audience out there, there's an old book by the great speechwriter and poet and playwright Robert Sherwood, who's written Roosevelt and Hopkins. And I suggest if people want to really learn about Harry Hopkins, they should, look into that book. It's a very, very terrific book on the New Deal and Hopkins. And probably Hopkins could have been president. But, of course, he was quite sick himself and suffered from stomach cancer and died within a year after Roosevelt's death, which was, I think, a great loss to the country. There's been much talk recently about Frances Perkins, who was America's first woman cabinet secretary. And, of course, this is the 75th anniversary of Social Security, and there's been a great deal of focus on her influence with FDR and social policy. Could you tell us something about Perkins and her role regarding Social Security and her importance to FDR and the country?
Yeah, she was just a remarkable person. She graduates from, Mount Holyoke College in 1904. She's comes from a very middle-class family that expected her not really to work, or if she did work, to become a teacher, nothing more than that. And she broke away. She did become a teacher, but moved to Chicago to do it, where she could also work with Jane Addams at Hull House, and got very caught up in the Settlement House movement. Then she moves to Philadelphia, where she takes a job that involves, in part, rescuing women who arrive at the docks from overseas or from the South, rescuing them before they can get lured into prostitution by pimps. And she actually fought off a few pimps. So she was really down there in the trenches doing, social work and progressive work of that kind. Moves to New York, gets a master's degree, and personally witnesses the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, and she was already becoming an authority on social work, on factory safety, but right. at that point, having witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, she really became a major force in New York for calling on the factories to be cleaned up and made safer. And by doing that, she caught the eye of Al Smith, who becomes governor. He appoints her industrial commissioner. FDR keeps her on in that capacity, and then she goes with him to Washington, D.C. She was the leading progressive voice, I would say, in FDR's inner circle during the 100 days and really throughout the New Deal. She kept on saying, you know, whatever you do, there must be public works programs to put people to work. Mm. There must be a federal relief program. And I've already described how she got FDR to accept that proposal that Hopkins came up with. And then she also really pushed for Social Security. So after the first round of reforms and legislation in the 100 days and after, FDR begins 1935 with the idea that now the moment is right to finally tackle Social Security, and he appoints Perkins to head the commission that develops it, and it came up with a wide array of really important ideas. So it was old age pensions, but also, remember, it was unemployment insurance, which Frances Perkins had been fighting for unemployment insurance since she was working for FDR in Albany. Also included aid to the disabled, the blind, and others. It became a very progressive blueprint, and Congress adopted it. Perkins was the driving force. She was the mother of Social Security, and it was, you know, her good judgment throughout that led to a lot of the specifics of the law that we have today. It's you know, one of the, you know, great disappointments I had in working on the book is how little appreciated she is. Mm-hmm. School children should all know the name Frances Perkins and should know what she's done, because she really is one of the great Americans. And as you mentioned, there's been a little attention to her lately. My book, there's been a new biography that's come out about her. And I think that one thing that, you know, a lot of us who study the period would like to do is to try to bring her to greater prominence, which she richly deserves.
Yeah, you served on a panel recently that I attended, a very, very interesting panel. I was there down at the Harvard Club for 5 hours. I had to come up for air, and you served with, I know, Kirsten Downey, who has written a book on a very well-documented book on Frances Perkins. Of course, Frances Perkins wrote a book on her, a biography of herself, quite a number of years ago, not long after she left the administration. And she had a fascinating life, a much different life. The people who worked in Washington in those days were not the dollar-a-year people and the rich plutocrats that we think of Washington, you know, people today. They were pretty much average citizens who took, it's a lot of sacrifice to work, and they didn't get paid, you know, a great deal of money, interestingly. And she came to FDR almost with a kind of demand when he approached her for the job. Isn't that true?
Right. She said to him, you know, I will take the job under the condition that you support, you know, the following agenda. And she listed a number of things that she wanted to see done during his presidency. And they really were the backbone of the New Deal. I mean, and they were, a lot of them were quite radical proposals at the time. But she wanted a federal welfare program for the victims of the Depression. She wanted a public works program. She wanted an end to child labor, which was still incredibly common. She wanted minimum wage and maximum hour laws. And she got all of these things. You know, she drew up the bill, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which created the minimum wage and maximum hours. And yes, she persuaded FDR to sign on to this, you know, very ambitious agenda. And part of the reason was she was somewhat ambivalent about joining the administration. As you alluded to, it was a sacrifice for her. She had a husband who no one knew about, but he was mentally ill, and she had been taking care of him. She had a daughter that she also had to care for, and she was the main breadwinner in the family, and it was very difficult to move down to Washington. And we think now of the life of a cabinet secretary as being, you know, very lavish and having a large staff, but that wasn't the case when Perkins mm-hmm. became Secretary of Labor. When she moved down to Washington, literally, she had no car to take her to the inauguration. I tell the story about how she had to, like, run through the mud to try to get to the inauguration, and she and Henry Wallace, the agriculture secretary, arrived halfway through the inaugural address because they they couldn't get to it on time. And then the following Monday, when it's time for her to report to work at the Department of Labor to be the secretary, no one had told her where it was. She literally had to look up the address in the phone book, and then she called up and said she was coming. And the outgoing Secretary of Labor, who had been appointed by Hoover, didn't want to leave, and she had to actually stand in the office and help him to pack up and to supervise the removal of his stuff and to tell him finally that he had to leave the office because she was now the Secretary of Labor. So these were very different times from today. Right. And it was not an easy life, but they also, by the same token, were able to get an extraordinary amount of work done. Things changed.
You know, it's interesting, as you brought up, you mentioned the name Henry A. Wallace Jr. I don't know whether he's a junior, but he was certainly, I believe, the third of two famous predecessors, his father, who was a cabinet official in the Coolidge and Hoover administrations, actually, I think, Harding and Coolidge administration, and differed with Hoover and caused him to drop dead, and his grandfather. And these were great farmers, agronomists. Hoover actually Henry Wallace actually created a formula for hybrid corn that made that family a fortune. But he was actually one of the most popular individuals in the history of the New Deal. Later on, he lost popularity, because of his run on the progressive line and, the McCarthy period. But he was a very, very popular individual because the farms were in such terrible shape. You know, a lot of people don't realize that. You know, many old timers are familiar with FDR's confidant, alter ego, political advisor, and great supporter, Louis Howe. Did Louis Howe lose influence once FDR was in office? And what about his other political operatives like Jim Farley and Ed Flynn?
Yeah, Howe was an enormous force in FDR's life. And if you look at the lowest point in FDR's life, when he got polio, and he was almost ready to give it all up, and his mother, Sarah, wanted him to give it all up and to just retire to Hyde Park and lead the life of a gentleman farmer. It was really Howe and Eleanor who persuaded FDR that polio did not mean that he couldn't, have larger ambitions, and who persuaded him to run for governor. So Howe was very involved in that, and also in the nitty gritty of planning those races. Very involved in planning the 1932 presidential election, and in choosing Raymond Moley, who we spoke about, to head the Brains Trust. So Howe was a very important force and someone that FDR really leaned on. But yes, when FDR became president, Howe's role diminished in part because he just wasn't a policy person. So they were still quite close, and Howe was his close advisor and lived in the White House, actually. But Howe wasn't the sort of person who could tell FDR how to create a New Deal, how to save the Farm Belt, how to put people back to work. And he got pushed aside a little bit by Raymond Moley and some of the other, brainier people who came in. And then there were people like Farley, who you mentioned, and Ed Flynn. Those were the political guys. And FDR was at heart a politician. He understood the importance of politics. He loved to talk politics. He, knew all about, appealing to various constituencies. And he put Flynn in as his postmaster general, and they got along very well. But those were political people. And FDR had, I think, the very good instinct to look to different people for the nitty-gritty of running government. So he had his Flynns and his Howes to make sure he got reelected, to make sure that, the voters were happy. But he also had people like Perkins and Wallace and Hopkins, who were real experts in their field, to do the drafting of legislation and to come up with the policies. And that was a world that someone like Howe and Flynn really couldn't be part of.
Yeah, it's very interesting because as a student of FDR, Howe is so critically important. There hasn't been a lot written on him. There's one book on Howe called Roosevelt and Howe, written in the early 50s. And I'll think of the name of the author in a second, but it's interesting that Howe dies in early 1936, and really, I've always felt that Roosevelt didn't have that close confidant who could speak to him frankly, and it's possible that the court packing and the ill-fated purge of attempted purge in 1938 of conservative senators that started to oppose the New Deal and put roadblocks in its way was probably caused because he didn't have a house said, you know, don't go that path, you know. And I always felt those were two of Roosevelt's strategic errors in regarding that. You know, you discuss extensively the philosophical struggle between the conservative players in the Democratic Party who are out of the picture, like John Raskob and John W. Davis. But what about the new ones like Lewis Douglas and Hugh Johnson? How extensive was their influence and who won out as the New Deal matured?
Well, the Lewis Douglas story is an amazing one, and it's one of the things I talk a lot about in the book. Lewis Douglas was a major budget cutter. He believed that the government was spending too much money, that we needed fiscal conservatism, and that was his reputation as a member of Congress from Arizona, a very young member of Congress, very charismatic member of Congress. FDR just falls in love with the guy and makes him budget director at the beginning of his administration during the 100 days, raises that up to cabinet level, and looks to Douglas for a lot of guidance about how to carry out the New Deal. So he's got these progressives who are saying, big program, spend a lot of money to fight the Depression. And then he's got Lewis Douglas saying, we can't afford any of this. Douglas was very close to FDR and got his way at the beginning quite a bit. So the second law that is passed during the 100 days after they save the banking system is the Budget Act, which cuts the federal budget by 25%. Douglas gets everything he wants. And FDR was so smitten with Douglas at the beginning of his administration that he actually told people that he thought that Douglas would be a very good successor for him as president. Well, that's the beginning of the 100 days through about April. But it soon becomes clear that the problems of the Great Depression are so large that they're going to need big programs, big public right. works programs, big welfare programs, and that's going to cost a lot of money. And that's when the clash began. The progressives like Francis Perkins and Harry Hopkins and Henry Wallace were fighting for those big programs. Lewis Douglas was fighting tooth and nail against them, going right. to FDR saying, we can't afford it, it's going to destroy the government. When they went off the gold standard, Lewis Douglas was unconsolable and said that he thought it was the end of Western civilization. Right. And this tension really continued through the 100 days, but it was clear who was going to win. The progressives had to win. So Douglas becomes more and more disenchanted, and by the end of 1934 is quite miserable, leaves the government, and is quite embittered about his experience because his vision of a small government and a government with, you know, fiscal austerity during a depression just couldn't survive, and he ended up being tossed out with it.
Yeah. I want to remind our audience you're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming worldwide on WVOX with my great guest, Mr. Adam Cohn of the New York Times editorial board and author of Nothing to Fear about FDR's first 100 days in office. I want to switch subjects in our last segment and have Adam talk a little bit about what's happening in Washington today. First of all, with a new set of polls showing Congress at almost the low levels of the Bush administration and gridlock over some big issues like health care reform, Wall Street and banking regulation. What's the prognosis for the second year of the Obama administration? I've noticed he's shifted position and has looked very presidential in the last few weeks. What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's been a very, very tough, you know, year. And if you look back to the presidential election, all of the great enthusiasm that came out of it, the yes, we can, and so forth, it's been amazing how tough a slog it has been. And I think a lot of it has been that Congress has been so intransigent. And this is a Congress that the Democrats control, by the way. But Obama has not had the luxury, FDR had, of a Congress that was willing to let him lead and to, you know, give him the legislation he needed. So it's been a tough fight every step of the way. Obama's had to deal with this rule of 60 in the Senate, which is not a constitutional rule, but a rule of custom, which is that you need 60 votes for things to happen in the Senate. And that's just been very, very hard right. for the Democrats. So it's one reason we still haven't gotten the health care bill, why other legislation has been, you know, on a very slow track. And I think a real wake-up moment for the administration came in this recent special election in Massachusetts for Senator Ted Kennedy's seat. That is a very blue state. You and I have already talked at the beginning of the show about our ties to the state, and the thought that the Democrats could not get another Democrat in to Ted Kennedy's old seat was really quite stunning. But that sent a message, I think, that whatever the administration was doing was not working, that, you know, there was a bit of a revolt among the voters. I think the Obama administration is rightfully quite worried about the midterm elections coming up this fall and whether the Democrats will lose seats or even, you know, it's a long shot, but maybe losing one of the houses. So I think Obama has had to, rejigger things a bit and change his approach. And we saw after Massachusetts, Obama became a little more populist in his rhetoric, spoke out a little bit more against the bank bailout and the necessity for it and the bankers. We're now hearing some indications from the White House that they may support the public option in healthcare reform, which is something that Obama said during the campaign he would support and which a lot of progressives support. So I think we're seeing an administration that post-Massachusetts is now looking to make sure that it really still has enough popular support to do well in the midterms and to keep carrying out its agenda. And I think everyone would just say it's just been a lot harder than people expected.
Right. This brings us to a point that there seems to be a synapse when it comes to understanding perception and actuality. Polls show few people even know there was a tax cut. Few know that Congress has been quite busy and decently successful. Few people seem to realize that our healthcare system is in grave trouble, and I'll allude to the New York Times editorial page of today. It is 3.5 times more expensive than the average healthcare system in the whole Western world, and the quality of our care is, someone said, 17th from the top. You are the editorial page, and you're part of the editorial board today, wrote in the New York Times about the incredible increases we're seeing from insurers. Everybody talks, we saw advertisements on how government is going to control your care and parcel it out, but that's what the insurance companies do every day. Why has this come about, the synapse, this lack of understanding, and have the lobbies, I believe there were 3,300 lobbies spending over $1 billion, shape thinking completely in this country?
Well, I'm afraid that they do have more influence than ever before. It does seem like everyone agreed that we couldn't have a healthcare reform package unless all of the, big corporate interests, the pharmaceutical industry, the hospitals, and so forth, all were happy with it. And it is true that the people are not as informed as they need to be. One story that people point to as an example of this is, some months ago, one of the members of Congress from South Carolina, I believe, was having a meeting back home, and one of his constituents got up and said, that he was very worried about all this health care reform, and, he wanted the government to keep its hands off of his Medicare program. And, literally, he did not seem to know that Medicare is, of course, a government program, and that's the reason he's getting health care. Right. So it's very frustrating to a lot of people that that there isn't a very deep understanding about the way it all works and the way it's going on, whereas the lobbyists know every little detail, and they're writing a lot of the legislation or making suggestions constantly. So it's a troubling dynamic, and it only seems to be getting worse. We just got a ruling from the Supreme Court last month that is giving corporations the right to spend an unlimited amount of money in federal elections, which they can use to push members of Congress and even the White House further to do what they want. So it's, a lot of people are now saying that Washington seems to be broken and getting worse, and it's not clear what the path out of this is, but something has to change because it's not working right now.
Unfortunately, this has been, we're running out of time. It's been a fascinating conversation. As usual, it's always great to talk about FDR. It's always important to relate his time to our time. I want to thank you, Adam, for joining me. And I want to express to my audience that to go out and get this book, Nothing to Fear, It's Around in All the Stores. Thank you very much for coming on.
It's This was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, and good luck. And I'm waiting to hear some opinions from the editorial page on the Tea Party people. I know that's going to be a very interesting subject in the coming year. Thank you very much. Next week, there'll be a rebroadcast of my show about New York City's hidden stories and neighborhoods with Art and Susan Zuckerman. If you want to hear this program and any of the other Archive Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com. You can learn more about Adam Cohn and Nothing to Fear at the Penguin website, us.penguingroup.com. I'm sure everybody will get a great education reading his book. Thank you again, Adam, and have a great day, okay?
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Be well. Thank you.